Yes. 25, 28. Have we done that one?
No.
No?
Nope.
Okay. Let's do 25, 28, shall we? Want to? Forgive me for the lack of, like, current names, but these are the ones that come to mind. If I said the name to you, Bill Clinton, what comes to mind as you think about his presidency, for those of you maybe that are a little bit older?
Monica.
Monica, right? Along with a long list of other female names, right? Monica was one of many.
He put in his mouth. He didn't inhale.
Yeah. Marijuana, apparently, or whatever back in the college days. Well, that was pre-presidency, I think. I don't know. So now it's all legal, so you can do whatever you want, I suppose. If I said the name Mike Tyson to you?
Tigers.
Ears.
Ears, right. Was it Evander Holyfield?
Yeah.
Bit both of his ears in the midst of a boxing match.
That's so weird.
Prison, yeah. Tatted up. Just an interesting guy that his fleshly desires took over. Ricky Williams, you guys remember that guy? He played for University of Miami. Not Miami, I'm sorry. He played for the Miami Dolphins for a season and some other teams. I can't remember where he went to college. He had an insane amount of talent. Like, it was just a big, impressive running back. But he had a problem with marijuana. The guy just wanted to party all the time. And he could not stop partying, and his football career was ultimately run short. And he basically told everybody, he's like, no, I basically enjoy smoking marijuana more than I enjoy playing football, so I'm going to go do that. Everybody see you later. I think of, not to bag on our president, but as we talk about just control of your flesh, like, I feel like, man, about 140 characters at a time, our current president is just making a mockery of himself on some days. You just look at the things that hit Twitter and you go, dude, is there anyone around you that just tells you to shut up and put your phone down and not say stuff? Like, just keep your mouth closed, run the country, and, you know. But, man, just every single thing, it's got to be this back and forth, and he's got to win. And the idea being Proverbs 25, verse 28. Last verse of Proverbs 25. Like a city that is broken into and without walls is a man who has no control over his spirit. The idea being a city without walls. You guys know what that picture is. You're a sitting duck, literally, you're a turtle on your back. You are defenseless, you are hopeless, you are going to go down, it's just a matter of time. The same picture is true for a man or a woman, in that case, who has no self-control, no control over their spirit. The word is ruach. It's the same word that's used for, it's the spirit in the Old Testament. It's used of the Holy Spirit, but the spirit within you, your cravings, your desires, like your, it's the idea of literally self-control. We all have things, right, that we need to be aware of in our flesh, and we think through, folks, and there's probably plenty currently in the news cycle that are hitting those things that are just devastating their own lives because of a lack of self-control. And there's certain people that are going to go down in history. I mean, Clinton was 20 years ago, and as we think about him, man, he in a lot of ways was a very gifted president. But we think about often now his faults and his shortcomings instead of his accomplishments, regardless of what you thought of him as a president. He had some pretty significant giftings with people, but is blowing it now. So as you think about your life and as you think about your inner cravings, so often, if we are not careful, we'll let those things be the things that define us. Okay, so as young men and women, we need to figure out how to control those cravings, how to make sure that we are not those that have no control over our spirit, lest we are cities without walls. All right? Any other characters you guys can think of that are current? People that come to mind that exemplify this for you? What's that?
Charlie Sheen.
Oh, gosh, man. That's a great one. He's a disaster. Has he turned his life around yet? I know he was.
I mean, he did his new show, but I don't know.
I haven't seen that one. Yeah, he was in the news for all the wrong reasons for a long time. Speaking of addictions, his list is too long.
Gibson, the hot little stint of time right after Passion.
Yeah, he, gosh, Passion and then anti-Jewish remarks and, yeah, alcohol stuff with him. I mean, the list goes on and on, right? So, just fascinating, right? That's something that we just need to be aware of. I'll give you some things next week in line with that, that just are kind of consistent things that maybe big picture areas for us to all think through. Self-control, the ability to do that, the ability to put, we've talked about this concept before, a gun on safety so that its firing mechanism does not go off. That is a unique and very valuable skill set to have when you don't have to respond in kind or follow flesh or whatever it may be. All right. Cool. We're going to see some bad examples of that this morning. So with that, let's go back to 2 Samuel now that we found ourselves there. Let's dive into David, kind of a fun morning to see now finally him moving into the promises that God has given him, beautiful picture of God's faithfulness over a decade, almost two decades, from promise to fulfillment. So with that, Jimmy, you pray for us, my friend.
Father, Lord, thank you for this. Thank you for this wonderful day. Bless us with God. Lord, thank you for giving us the ability to be able to wake up today, be able to come here, be able to learn about your word, learn about your will for us. God, as we read through the book of 2 Samuel, as we just continue to just put our hearts on you, because that was as we just continue to do that, and that we can use that outside of this class as well. Amen.
All right. So, 2 Samuel 1, we covered a little bit yesterday, the idea of, big picture again, just the idea of the establishment of the kingdom. God is finally going to give to David what he has promised him as a 13-year-old boy back in Bethlehem. He will be close to 30 years old by the time he finally gets, or will be 30 years old by the time he finally gets the kingdom. And it's only a partial uniting. Dude, what's going on over here, guys? You going to sing a song, too? What's going on? Like, Stephanie, you okay? Was that awkward for you, too? Okay, just confirming. Oh, my gosh, you guys are a mess. Chapter 1, obviously, we saw the death of Saul at the end of chapter, end of 1 Samuel chapter 31, and now the coronation of that, or just the remembrance of Saul, and God, through David, properly remembering his chosen king. Okay, so now in chapter 2, we're going to see David now that Saul's dead and he's done what he feels is right in honoring them, asking God what's next. Chapter 2, verse 1, let's pick up there.
Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to the cities of Israel? And the Lord said, go up. And so David said, where shall I go up? And he said, to Hebron.
Now, remember, the area of Judah was the area smack dab in the middle of Saul's territory, right? So he's... This is not, it's been a place he's avoided for the last decade plus of his life. And he's saying, now, God, do I have a green light to go? Can I go to Judah? The idea, are they going to accept me there? And he says, go to Hebron. So David went up there, and his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. David brought up, verse 3, his men, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. So Hebron is south of Jerusalem, currently a Palestinian occupied city. It's one of the worst, like most volatile cities currently in the area of Israel that isn't Gaza, in terms of its anti-Jewish sentiments for sure today. So important city back then, important city now. Okay, verse 4, the men of Judah came and anointed David king over the house of Judah. So David's, his tribe, the men of Judah now, anoint him. So he has got a partial piece of the kingdom, if you will. They told David in verse end of verse 4 that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were the men that buried Saul. So at this point, David has the green light from some of the tribes, but not all of the tribes. So he's got a partial piece of the whole kingdom. So Benjamin and other places, they aren't convinced that they're going to follow David yet. They're still in line with Saul, and we're going to see a coup that's about to rise up. But it's going to be another 7 years, 7.5 years before David gets the entire nation of Israel underneath his kingship, okay? But he has an initial foothold in the land, okay? Now, if you're David, and you just found out that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones that took Saul's body off the wall that we read about yesterday, they had honored Saul, how are you going to respond? And maybe if you're from Jabesh-Gilead, what are you fearful of at this point? Exactly. So a lesser king, doesn't do what David's about to do, he would have handled this differently. This is what David says now in verse 5. Read that.
David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your lord and have buried him. Now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I will also show this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and valiant, for Saul your lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them."
All right, so he doesn't punk them for saying, "Hey, look, you were loyal to Saul, I get it, right? That was, it was great what you did." Honors them and says, "Now your king is dead. Let's move on, and God has anointed me king over all of Israel," or over all of Judah at the very least at this point. The problem is now verse 8. Read that.
"But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over Tamahanim. He made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and over all of Israel." All
right, so David kind of has the south, if you will, Judah, and kind of that area. But the northern kingdom, the northern part of Israel that's kind of geographically divided, Abner, this is Saul's old commander, he's not having it. He's still loyal to Saul, and he's going to take now Ish-bosheth, Saul's only surviving son, right, his fourth-born son, and he's going to make him the puppet king. He's putting him in there. He's the marionette behind all of this, and Ish-bosheth really is a puppet. And he says, "Man, you're going to be king. The people follow him." Verse 10, Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. So we've got now this divide. Abner's not letting go of this opportunity. Abner, you're going to see, is a very interesting guy, and you can kind of make your own determination about how you feel about him. He is an opportunist, and he sees an opportunity. Obviously, he likes his job as being commander of Israel, and he wants to keep it. So he's not a fan of who, by the way, would be taking his job, most likely. Not David, who would be taking Abner's job? Joab. Okay, that's David's commander. So he realizes, I have something to lose in this. Now, if my king is still king, then I get to be his lieutenant, go fight battles, and that's ultimately what it seems like here Abner's after. He doesn't want the power to transfer from Saul's house now to David's house. So this is a big deal. So he becomes king, at least at the north. David, in verse 11, was king of Hebron over the house of Judah for 7 years and 6 months. So we're going to see now, God has given him a partial fulfillment of this promise, but it's not fully fulfilled in terms of the totality of the area.
Just to be clear before I take note, southern kingdom's Judah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so just looking at kind of the territory, David's in Hebron, which is, again, south, about midway down the Dead Sea, west, straight over. Hebron's in that area, a little further down, actually. So that's kind of the divide of the land right now. Now, verse 12, let's pick up there and let's watch this this conflict arise between these two military commanders, Abner and Joab.
"Now Abner the son of Ner went out to Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ish-bosheth the son of Saul. And Joab the son of Zeruiah and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other side on the other side of the pool."
All right, this is a fascinating picture. So Joab and Abner are going to meet each other in battle. Okay, and they each have kind of their select few men with them. And instead of fighting this huge battle, they're going to have a different way of going about deciding who's going to be the victor. Okay, keep reading, Alex.
Then Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and hold contest before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." And so they arose and went over by court, by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 for the servants of David.
All right, so we're going to have a 12-on-12 battle, 12 from Abner's side, 12 from Joab's side, similar to like David and Goliath, right? So instead of the whole army's fighting, you pick your best, I'll pick our best, and they're going to fight and determine who is going to win, and the loser is going to be the servant of the other. Now we're going to play a game of chicken, basically. We're going to have a 12-on-12 battle, and each guy is going to be paired up with another, okay? So we have 24 men total, each paired up, so 12 mini battles going on. Okay, now here is the picture. This is crazy. Look at 16.
"Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side so that they fell down together."
Okay, so the idea is you're standing across from your opponent, right? I have his head in one hand and my left hand and my sword in my right, and I have it literally in his side like this. And he's standing opposite of me with my head in his hand and a sword in my side. It's a game of chicken. Who's going to lose? And you went 1, 2, 3, whoosh. And the first person to say, I'm out, is the loser. Okay? Nobody went out. So 24 men. No, 24. It just gutsy. I mean, I'd have been like, see ya, peace. Like, I know how this is going to end. I like my wife and kids. Bye, right? 24 men die instantaneously together. Okay? So nothing is solved at this point.
What does that word mean?
Which one?
Oh, the field of sword edges?
Hebron?
No, those.
Sorry. Oh, therefore the place was called, yeah, that word that I can't pronounce. Where's Derek when you need him? Which is in Gibeon. And it, field of sword edges? Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Now, Joab's ticked, okay? That day the battle was very severe since there was no conclusion here. Now they're going to have a real battle. Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Joab has the view that Abner's the one that kind of picked this fight. Joab's the one that's going to finish the fight, if you will. So they are now going to go off and they're going to finish this battle. Look at now at verse 18. Alex, read that.
Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Ashiel. And Ashiel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles in the field.
All right, pause right there for a second. So let me show you guys. Look at this, I'm on a mirror. Yeah, he's Usain Bolt. This is a family tree. Can you guys see that? Can I make it more bigger? Sure. This is David's family tree. Okay, so just to give you guys an idea. So here's Jesse up here. Okay. Here's David. These are all his wives. Okay, so we got more coming. We ain't done. And these are, this is his brothers and sisters. Okay, read the verse about, read 18.
Now there are three sons of Zeruiah.
So three sons of Zeruiah. Zeruiah is David's sister. Okay, the three sons of Zeruiah are Joab, Abishai, and Ashahel. Okay, so these three guys, Joab and the others, are what to David? These are his nephews, okay? So their uncle David is the king of Israel, okay? So just remember that. These guys are going to be interesting. Now, is family, right? You would do that. You put your most trusted people, which are usually family, in positions of authority or whatever. But these three sons now are in battle against Abner now and his the former commander of Saul's armies. Okay, so you guys can just see that. Now, on the left here, you see four of David's wives. We'll talk through some of those later. He's got a big family, and we'll get to kind of the details of that. But just want you to know the relationship with Joab and these guys. So they are younger than David, right? So, but this is his uncle David's nephews. Okay, keep reading.
Ashiel pursued Abner and did not turn right or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is that you, Ashiel?" And he said, "It is I." So Abner said to him, "Turn to your right or to your left, and take a hold of one of the young men for yourself, and take for yourself his spoil." But Ashiel was not willing to turn aside from following.
So the idea is, man, the battle's been lost. Joab and his men have won that day, but Joab is continuing to pursue Abner because he's ticked because this whole battle started in the first place, and Abner put Ishbosheth as king, so there's this frustration that's going on. Ashiel is the youngest of these brothers, and he wants a trophy. He wants to take down Abner, and he wants to put his head on his mantle, right, with the, you know, the buck or whatever. That's the idea. This is the guy that you want to take down, so he won't stop pursuing him. Abner is older. Abner is far more experienced, and he's basically telling Ashiel, go away. You don't want any of this. On this one-on-one battle, this trophy buck is not going to be your trophy duck. I'm going to kill you is the idea. So he's telling him, hey, turn aside. Why should I strike you to the ground in verse 22? How then can I lift up my face to your brother Joab? Dude, if you keep pursuing me, I'm going to kill you. Leave me alone. So he's warned him now twice. However, pick up in 23, Alex.
However, you refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear, so that the spear came out of his back.
Now, sorry, that... He didn't even strike him with the tip of the spear. He strikes him with the back of the spear. He impales him with a broom handle. That's Abner. So apparently this guy can fight, and he warned Ashiel twice, leave me alone. I don't want to have to look at your brother Joab in the face and tell him that I killed you. So go away. He didn't listen. Ashiel is this young, zealous, you know, warrior. I mean, give him an A+ for courage, and maybe not, he didn't realize what he was up against. So he dies now in verse 23. What's that, Kyle?
I said he's also a little soft.
He is a little soft. Apparently he's pudgy or something. I don't know. He squishes with swords easily. So, but Abner's a tough guy. So you're seeing this inner family, you know, or Saul versus David kind of rivalry brewing, and it's getting worse. So Joab and Abishai now pursued Abner. They continue now to fight because they find out their brother's dead. The sons of Benjamin gather now in verse 25 behind Abner. And Abner says, man, hey, verse 26, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know how this will end in bitterness? Basically, like, just stop. Like, this, we've already lost. We're running home. Leave us alone. Like, just let us go in peace. How long will you refrain in verse 26 from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers? Okay, Joab said, as God lives, if you had not spoken, in verse 27, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother. So Joab's saying, man, because you had the audacity kind of to ask me to quit pursuing you, I'm going to continue to pursue you. So you're seeing some character traits within Joab. Man, he is just like, he's got bloodlust lenses on. He wants vengeance, he's angry, and his passions are causing him to maybe make lapses in judgments here after he's already won kind of this so-called battle, okay? So 28, Joab ends up blowing the trumpet, calls off the dogs, says, man, we're done. Abner and his men, verse 29, leave. They go through the Arabah, so south of the Dead Sea, and they cross over the Jordan River east into the east side of the Jordan, and they flee. Joab returns, verse 30, with Abner, with all the people, and they find out that Asahel was missing. The servants of David, verse 31, struck down many of the Benjamites that day. Abner's men, 360 men die in this battle. So what started as kind of a 12-on-12 battle, now Abner's lost 360 men. And Asahel, they found him, buried him, and honor him. And during this season, the 7.5 years, look at 3 verse 1, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And during this time, David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. So it's just kind of a slow erosion of the power of Saul. Abner's realizing what's happening around him, and it's a bad season. Ultimately, this is going to end, obviously, for David's success, but Abner is not letting go easily. He's determined, okay? Now, verses 2 and following, you're going to get a genealogy of David and his wives that we're now going to see now, and his kids. So let's just take note of that. Alex, pick up there in verse 1.
Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually.
Sorry, I meant verse 2, but that's good too.
I'm sorry. Sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon, by Ahinoam.
Okay, pause there. So you got Amnon right here. Okay, he's the firstborn. So remember this guy. Obviously, the firstborn in a family is very important. Okay, and Ahinoam, however you say her name, that's wife number one, or had the first kid. Okay, keep rolling.
In his second, Chalid,
yep.
By Abigail.
Abigail. So Abigail is Nabal's, you know, the pretty wife that David took from the fool Nabal. So we've got Chalid. Keep going.
The widow of Nabal, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And third, Absalom, the son of Maacah.
Okay, Absalom. Where's he? Absalom's over here. Okay, so remember that guy. So Absalom has a sister by the name of Tamar. They are full brother and sister from the same mom. Okay, remember that. Amnon, the firstborn, is going to have an interaction with her later, and it's going to involve Absalom as well. Okay, Absalom will be a key player in the story moving forward as well. Okay, who else we got?
We got the daughter of Tamai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonai, the son of Haggith.
Okay, Adonijah, okay, remember him. And it's some of these guys aren't super important, okay? But the ones you do want to remember, Absalom and Tamar, full blood brother and sister, Amnon the firstborn, Absalom, where did he go? Not Absalom, sorry, Adonijah as well. Okay, those are the sons that we're going to see spoken of. Way over here, you've got Solomon, okay, obviously from Bathsheba. So we'll see him come on the scene later. He's not born yet. He's coming later. Bathsheba obviously is not one of David's wives yet. That story's coming as well. So he's got a bunch. So can you you said it, Joseph. What was the word?
Train wreck.
This is a train wreck, right? So when you're a king and you've got this many wives, I mean,
Bathsheba was married to
Bathsheba was married to Uriah the Hittite.
Okay.
We'll see how his he's grayed out for a reason. He's going to die. Bathsheba then becomes the wife of David. They're going to have two kids together. The firstborn's going to die, dead son of David. And then we'll see them have Solomon together. And he'll be obviously...
Were the others her sons?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wait. Tamar, the king?
Tamar the king?
Wait, Tamar's Tamar a king?
No, Tamar's a girl.
Tamar's a girl, right?
Mm-hmm. Tamar is David's daughter.
Oh, I'm pronouncing that name wrong. My bad. Sorry. Okay.
Good. So, it's Tamar. Big. Okay. It's confusing. There's a lot of wives on this family tree, okay? But I just want you guys to see overall. Now, remember, David starts this, right? What's Solomon going to do when he becomes king?
The same thing.
He's going to do the same thing times like a bazillion, right? 900 wives and concubines. What does Solomon say? 1,000.
Like
700 wives, 300 concubines, something like that. It's an insane amount of, you know, whatever. So remember that, right? What you may do in small compromise, man, you get, is it passes down the family lineage? What was maybe sketchy for them is now completely acceptable the next line down, okay? So we got a lot of wives.
Tamar and Absalom's Tamar is a sister of Absalom. Absalom named his daughter Tamar as well.
Yeah, and you'll see why. Yeah, so, correct. There's a lot of Tamar. So obviously we saw Tamar in Genesis 34 in that story. There's some popular names. David has a wife named Abigail. David has a sister named Abigail. Okay, so popular name. Okay? All right. Alex, 3:6, pick up there.
Came about while there was a war between the house of Saul and the house of David that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul.
All right, so Abner again is playing his position for his authority. That's what he's looking for, okay? Keep rolling.
Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aha. Or
I like Aha.
Sure.
I like that.
Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?"
All right, now interpret this for me. So Saul had a concubine, and Abner, his commander, slept with Saul's concubine. What does that mean? What is Abner doing?
Isn't that like...
Just remember the story, yep.
Yeah, the story where he goes to Jacob or...
Almost. Yeah. Who slept with their father's concubine?
Yeah.
Reuben, the firstborn son, right, sleeps with daddy's concubine. And it's a big, fat... forgive the phrase, middle finger to dad saying, I'm the new guy in town, right? I'm the guy. I got hair on my chest. I want to be the king. So you're dead to me. That's exactly what Abner's doing. He's sleeping with Saul's former concubine to say, I'm linking myself to this family. Ishbosheth is a tool, and I'm using him for my purposes, okay? So Ishbosheth, the son of shame, confronts Abner now. And Abner says in verse 8, am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David, and yet today you charge me with guilt concerning a woman. Like, bro. So he gets confronted, and his response is, I have shown kindness to the house of Saul. What he means is, man, Abner, Ishbosheth, I've kept you in a prominent position, but dude, behind the scenes, you're a turd, man. You're completely playing this to your own advantages. That's what you're ultimately looking for. Now, verse 9, this is an odd response from Abner. Read that.
May God do so to Abner, and more so, if the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul, and to establish the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan even to Beersheba.
So what's Abner saying?
I have no idea.
He's telling Ishbosheth, because you confronted me, he says, if the Lord has sworn to David, as he has, that you're going to be the king, and I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from Saul to David. Abner's saying, I'm out. I'm switching teams. And my new job is to take the kingdom that's in Saul's hands and to transfer it to David's hands. Now, what's the problem with David right now? What does he not have? Why is the rest of the nation not following him? Yeah, so he's left. He's kind of seen by some as an abandoner. They know his story, but you've got all these people that have been loyal to Saul for 40 years, and now Saul's son, like it or not, is kind of being put in command. They're in between a rock and a hard place. Now, the thing that David could use more than anything is someone that's got 40 years of loyalty with Saul that says, man, you guys need to come over here with David. He's the new king in town. I am loyal to David as one of Saul's chief lieutenant. You guys come with me. So as a PR move, Abner would be a great choice to be able to get the rest of Israel to kind of transfer their allegiance to David. What Abner's motives are, we don't know. Okay, and we'll see in the text as it unfolds. But he's basically said to Ishbosheth, you're no longer king. You're done. How dare you confront me? Which is, you know, he's clearly on the defensive. We know why he confronted him. We know what Abner was going to do, but he doesn't say it. He says, now I'm going to transfer the kingdom to David.
Sorry, I'm still confused. So to clear this up in my head, Abner is saying, I'm the new chef in town, and my motives for what I did is so I can give it to David, not for myself.
I think previous to this, he's saying, behind the scenes, he put Ishbosheth in charge so that Abner could have a role. Ishbosheth confronts him, realizing, man, that's not all you wanted. You wanted the kingship. That's why you slept with my father's concubine. This wasn't just about me. You're trying to supersede me and be king. So he gets defensive and says, then great, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to now go to Team David and exalt him and let him be the king. Yeah.
Okay. Like, I don't like you.
Exactly. And ultimately what was behind that was he didn't like how he got confronted in his own sin. Abner's a strange guy. The problem with the story is he does exactly what he says he's going to do. And he convinces the people to follow David. So Abner and Joab are these two guys that every year when we get here, I'm just completely conflicted about how to feel about them.
Sorry, I'm a little lost on the story for Ishbosheth. I know who Ishbosheth is, mm-hmm. but... Like, at what point has he been nominated king?
He wasn't. He was, because this is a dynasty, he's the only surviving son of Saul, so he is the king.
But didn't he run off somewhere?
He does, yes, but Abner finds him and basically says, you're the king. So, hello, there you are, you know. So, against his will, really, but because he's the son of the king and the only son of the king, he's exalted, okay? So, yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces in this. It gets confusing quick, and it gets confusing-er. That would be more confusing. As we unfold it, okay? So he says, I'm out. Then Abner, verse 12, listen to what he does. Let's pick up there.
Then Abner sent messengers to David in his place, saying, who is in the land? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring you all Israel over to you.
So he sends David a note, says, man, I'm on your team now. So David's like, oh, all right. So verse 13.
He said, good. I will make covenant with you, but I demand you one thing. Namely, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see me.
All right, so he asked for Michal, right? His first wife, Saul's daughter. What's David doing? So Abner makes this command. He's like, man, that's great and all, Abner, who has been fighting against me as of like yesterday. Now you want to be on my team. So if you want to see me, here's my requirement. What's David ask for from Abner?
His wife.
Go get my first wife, who is Saul's daughter, who, by the way, is married to another dude right now. Saul gave her away. Why does David require this? Why? What is he doing?
Taking back his kingdom.
He's taking back his kingdom. So for David, what is he doing with Saul? He's linking himself to Saul through Michal, right? So I have authority to the throne, and the people follow me because Michal was my rightful first wife, okay? Why does he make Abner do this? Yeah, like if you're really loyal to me, then this will demonstrate that. Go get Michal, bring her to me. And Abner says, okay, I am truly loyal. So David sent messengers to Saul's son saying, give me Michal for the wife for whom I was betrothed. In verse 14, Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband. So Ishbosheth's a part of this as well. But her husband went with her weeping as he went and followed them. So like her poor husband, like that she's been married to now for however many years, over a decade, is like, wait a second, you're taking my wife? Yeah, she's going back to her first husband, David. He weeps and Abner says to him, shut up and go home. And verse 16, go and return. Abner had Consultation with the elders, it's so cold, right? But that's, man, it's like Game of Thrones, if you will, if you've read the books. It's just an odd, like, they don't care, man. It's just ruthless, right? In times you were seeking for David to be king over Israel. Sorry, listen to verse 17. We need to read this together. This is now what David says, or what Abner says, rather, to all of the elders of Israel, all the leaders of Israel who aren't yet on Team David. Okay, read 17.
Now Abner had consultation with the elders of Israel, saying, "In times past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken to David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'"
So what's Abner doing? He's basically out campaigning for David, telling the Israelites, come on over, right? It's the water's warm. It's great over here. You wanted David to be king in the past. You remember those statements from God? Now, stop talking about it and do it. Come over here and anoint him king. And he's saying, I've already transferred my allegiance. So Abner's going first, okay? He spoke in the hearing of the Benjamites in verse 19. Abner went to speak to the hearing of David and Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and the whole house of Benjamin. So if you're David, you're initially apprehensive, but now Abner's brought Michael. Abner's now gone and campaigned for you, and he said, man, Israel, come on. Like, we need to do this. We need to make David king. Verse 20, Alex, keep going.
Then Abner and the 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Abner said to David, let me arise and go and gather all of Israel to my lord, my king, that they may make a covenant with you and that you may be king over all your soul desires.
Like, man, like, this guy sounds like he's genuinely changed sides, right? Like, he's in. And David throws him a party, right? They all have dinner together. They come over to his house. They make some tri-tip, and they sit down and have a meal, David or Abner and his men. And, man, it looks like they're on good terms. Abner's proved his allegiance with Michael. He's gone out and not just talked the talk, but he's walked the walk. He's in. Problem is, who doesn't like this guy?
Joab.
Why would you be not a big fan of Abner if you're Joab? We killed your brother, right? He's done that. And you're a traitor, right? You just changed teams midstream. And what else if you're Joab? You got a guy competing for your job. So I don't want Abner around. He's older. He's more experienced. He's going to take my job. So 22, keep reading.
And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much soil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron before he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with them arrived, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he has gone in peace.
So Joab finds out, Abner came over for dinner, they all ate dinner, everything was cushy, they hugged, and, you know, all was good, and Joab's like, what the heck just happened, dude? I'm out fighting for you, David, and you brought in the commander of the enemy, and had dinner with them, and sent him away in peace? Like everything's okay, he can't figure it out, right? So Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why have you sent him away? And he's already gone, meaning, why don't you kill him? Like, he killed my brother. Like, that's your nephew. And now you're having dinner with this guy. So Joab is furious. This is what Joab's take is, and I think it's valid. 25.
You know, Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you and learn of your going in and your going out and all that you are doing.
So what's Joab's take? He's a dirty liar. He's a spy. That's exactly what he's doing. And in the story, we don't know. I mean, Abner's putting either on a great show and he's completely fooled David, or it's genuine and he really has changed teams. Joab clearly has his opinion. David has his. Okay? This is kind of where the conversation ends. So Joab says, man, I'm not getting anywhere with David. David's convinced that this is legitimate. So Joab says, well, I'll just take matters into my own hands then. 26.
Joab came out from David. He sent messengers after Abner and brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the middle of the gate to speak with him privately.
All right, so Abner and Joab now are privately speaking, right? They're having a conversation. Where? In what city?
Hebron.
That city should ring a bell to you guys. There were six of them, three on each side of the Jordan.
It's
48 Levitical cities. Six of them are cities of refuge. What was a city of refuge? What could you not do to someone in a city of refuge? Kill them. That was a safe place, right? So house arrest, for whatever reason, you weren't allowed to murder anybody. Not that murder's okay, but especially in these cities. Alex, keep reading.
So when Abner returned to Hebron, and there he stuck him in the belly, and he died on the account of blood of Asahel, his brother.
Abner never sees this coming. He thinks they're out having coffee, and all of a sudden, Joab reaches under the table and just guts him, like on the spot, in Hebron, and he kills him instantly. Verse 28.
Afterwards, when David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and all of his father's house, and may there not fail from the house of Joab one who is a discharge or who is a leper. One who has a discharge or who is a leper or who takes hold of distaff who falls by the sword or lacks bread.
All right, so what's David's response? What does he say? Dude, my hands are clean, okay? I didn't order this. I didn't command this. This is not for me, and may Joab's house get cursed. May have a bunch of lepers or whatever, right? So, like, this is on him. What do you see in that response? You know what? Pause there. Let's keep reading. I just want to play this out for you, okay? Joab and Abishai, verse 30. Joab told Abishai, his brother, that he killed Abner because he had put the brother Asahel to death. So family finds out about it. Then David said to Joab and all who were with them, tear your clothes, gird your sackcloth, and lament before Abner. What is he telling Joab and Abishai? What does that mean? To mourn. He's forcing them to mourn. Come to the funeral, put on your black suit, and cry a little bit. Okay? Act like you're sorry. Thus they buried Abner in Hebron. People wept in verse 32. 33, the king says, now a lament for Abner. Should Abner die as a fool, your hands are not bound or your feet in fetters. So David writes a psalm about the situation, right? This is his eulogy for Abner. Oh, it's awful, right? If you're David, what's the problem with the situation? What are you fearful of if you're David? The kingdom's going to turn on you. The northern kingdom is loyal to Saul and also Abner, and you just murdered him. How could this not involve David would be the assumption of the people, right? Why would David murder Abner? So David is trying to do what?
Make it be like he's not.
He's doing damage control right now. Hey, this isn't me. This is Joab. Here's a curse, and here's a sweet eulogy, and like, put your black suit on and come take a PR pic with me at the funeral and cry a little bit. Like, David's in damage control mode right now. When the people came, verse 35, to persuade David to eat bread while it was still day, David vowed, may God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down. So the question is David truly in mourning, which I think he is, or is he faking it and putting on a show? I don't think that's the case. In 37 now, look how the people respond to David's outward show, at least, of sorrow.
So all the people and all of Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner, the son of Ner, to death.
Okay, so they see, you know what? David, we believe you. Okay, so he's done his PR job, if you will. If that was his goal, or at the very least to distance himself, I think, from this murder, which I think David's right to do, to say that. The problem is, verses 38 and 39, I want you guys to begin to see a chink in David's armor. He has got an issue, and here it is in 38 and 39.
Then the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zerah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil.
All right, what's David saying? I am weak today, although anointed king. May these men, the sons of Zeruah, who are the sons of Zeruah? Joab and Abishai, the two remaining ones. Asahel is dead. They are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. What's David saying?
I'm not going to go take revenge of them all.
Well, I think if we go back to the reputation of
Abishai? Which one? The dead one?
Yeah, the dead one.
Okay. Asahel, sorry, is the one. Asahel. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. He kept taunting
Abner.
Abner.
Yep.
Repeatedly.
Yep.
To
consistently.
Yep.
And to the point, it's like Abner was like, "Dude, I don't want any part of this."
Yeah.
And then he basically sucker punched him and took him out. So then Joab is revenging, and his two nephews, I'm sure, are brainwashed with this revenge.
Yeah.
And so David's sitting there going, I don't understand the backstory. I don't understand what Joab is talking about
right.
to these guys, but I'm not going to sit there and make it my problem to fix what they are having an issue with. At least
so,
that's what I'm thinking.
I hear you. So there's a portion of it where you're like, look, Joab's just, man, it's an eye for an eye. So you killed my brother. I'm going to kill you. Fair enough. How did Joab go about this, though? He comes to David and says, bro, Abner looks like he's changed teams. He is not. He offers David counsel, and David ignores it. He says no, or believes what he chooses to believe. So Joab now is a loose cannon. He does whatever the heck he wants to. So he's going to murder a guy in cold blood in Hebron. This is not how this is supposed to go down. And David recognizes that. His blood is not on my hands. I did not do this. I did not kill Abner. And he's basically making the statement of, I disagree with what went down here, right? May these men be judged according to what they're doing. May God repay the evildoer according to his evil. Meaning, what Joab did was evil. David is acknowledging that. That's his belief about the situation. What is David failing to do?
Punish him.
Discipline Joab. Why? And he's his nephew. That makes it even more difficult, right? So Joab should have lost his job that day. He got fired, gotten thrown in prison, something, right? But David fails to discipline his nephew. And he clearly sees it. This is the issue, right? He knows what's wrong with him, but he won't do it. David lacks that hard edge that's necessary at times to lead, right? He's compassionate. You see his heart come out. Like everything else he does, man, is beautiful to see his response. And I think it's genuine. He is genuinely upset about the death of Abner, right? And I think, what's that?
He's a harmonizer.
He is, right? And I think it's a great thing about David. But because that, the dark side of a harmonizer, the dark side that we all have of our personalities, that relationship supersedes having to say the hard thing. Having to say as a persister, this is right, this is wrong. And regardless of how I feel about you, you have committed error. This issue is going to plague David his entire kingship. Okay? This is a problem for David. He will not execute justice when justice needs to be executed. Now, if you're Joab, what do you see right now? I've done wrong. I'm in sin. I know it. The king knows it. And what are the consequences?
No.
You're not going to do a dang thing to me. So what does Joab know? I've got an infinite get out of jail free card with the king. Because he doesn't have the chutzpah to deal with me. So, fascinating relationship that we're seeing very early on between David and his nephew. Who, by the way, is obviously years younger than David. Right? So David has the age advantage. He has the... You know, it's just an odd deal, right? So keep this in your mind as we're watching these stories unfold with David, with his family. This is an issue with David. He doesn't have a lot, but this is one of them. Well, maybe he doesn't have a lot.
Mad at Nabal. How can David get so mad and quick to kill?
Back with Nabal and... that one was, I think, regarding his men, that Nabal wouldn't feed his men. So you definitely see an anger issue there. To take care of his boys that weren't going to get fed. I think because this is family, it's different. David doesn't have the ability to deal with his family. So, okay. Now, verse 4, chapter 4 rather, let's pick up there.
I have one more comment.
Shoot.
I wonder if that's connected to like his brothers, always wanting his brothers to accept him because he was like younger and his brothers... didn't take him seriously, and so I wonder, does he have that desire to be accepted by his family, so he doesn't take action?
Yeah, what's the core need, Kyle, of a harmonizer?
Make everybody happy.
To be loved. I need you to like me, right? It's a real need, and it's genuine, and I think, Alex, to your point, yeah, he's the youngest kid, he's been overlooked his whole life. This isn't an issue that cropped up yesterday. This is an issue that's core to him, right? And that's a good, we all need to be loved, right? That's a core need for all of us. But there are times that that persister harmonizer conflict is the worst conflict in the world, right? When you've got to determine, what do I value more, the relationship or what's right to do in the relationship and the relationship's off? It's a disaster.
The thing of unity, wanting to keep people together.
Yeah.
You know, there's David, he's like, probably knows that he's got a weird messed up family and wants to make sure everything stays okay.
Yep.
And so it's like,
yeah.
We'll deal with him later.
Yeah.
You cry a little bit more,
yeah.
But you're, stop it. Yeah.
Totally. Wait and see.
What's Joab's relationship with Saul again?
Whose relationship with Saul?
What's Joab's relationship with Saul again?
Joab is David's commander. Abner was Saul's commander, so none. But they both had the same job for different kings.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Alex 4:1.
Now when Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage and all of Israel was disturbed.
So he realizes, okay, my marionette master is dead. I'm done. Keep rolling.
So Saul had two men with him who were the commanders of the bands, and one of them was Baanah, and the other...
Baanah.
What's his last name, Don?
Thank you. And the name of the other, Rechab, sons of Ramon, the Beerothite. The sons of Benjamin, for Baroth is considered part of Benjamin.
All right, so regardless, there's two guys, Baanah and Rechab, okay? Verse 5 now, this is what they got. These two punks do.
So the sons of Ramah the Beerothite and Rechab the Baanah departed and came to the house of Ish-bosheth in the heat of the day while he was taking his midday rest.
Okay, so the former king, or the puppet king, is laying down in the middle of the day taking a nap. And these two chumps, verse 6.
They came to the middle of the house as if they were to get weak. And they struck him in the belly, and Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped.
What do they do? They murder the guy in his sleep, right? This king. Then they come.
What's the deal with all the belly stabs? Like, is that like a certain type of kill? Like, why don't they chop their heads off?
It's a trend on Facebook.
Yeah. You just gut people. Saul's last son, Ish-bosheth, just got murdered. So Abner's gone. His protection's gone. What's your motivation, by the way? But if you're, why would you kill Ish-bosheth?
If you're David or who?
If you're anybody at this point, what's the advantage of murdering Ish-bosheth? Why would you do that?
Oh, you get yes, but you also get favor with David.
Exactly, right? So if I kill your last remaining competition, David, then how are you going to view me? Oh, thanks, man. You just took out, right? But they don't know David. They don't know what happened when the armor bearer, the lying armor bearer, comes to David and says, hey, I was in battle and I saw Saul and Jonathan and they got, you know, killed almost. And then they asked me to run them through and I saw this battle go on and here's their stuff that I have with me. You know, I killed them and I'm bringing their stuff to you. And David's like, oh, you don't get it, and runs the guy through. So how do you think this story's going to end? Similar.
What's a commander of bands? Is that like a small army? Or?
Yeah, small group of, like David's mighty men, but smaller. So like a little raiding party, if you will. So they take a few dudes with them. SEAL Team 6. All right. We got a lot more, yeah.
What's the purpose of the little interjection in verse 4 of Mephibosheth?
Wait on that and I'll get to it. Okay, we're gonna return there. Where are we at? 7, Kyle? Or 8. Alex? 8? Go for it.
Then they brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron and said, behold, the head of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life, thus the Lord has given my lord, the king, vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants.
Yeah, this guy sought your life. Here's his head. Woohoo! Let's party, David. That's the idea. David says, now, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from distress, when one told me, saying, behold, Saul is dead, he tells him the exact same story that I just told you. I seized him and killed him for the exact same thing that you just did. How much more, verse 11, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth? Damn. You are wicked men. Ish-bosheth was a righteous man. You murdered him while he was sleeping. You're cowards. Like, how much more did you think? Have you not heard the stories of what I did to that guy? They're like, man, not only are you wicked, but you're dumb, right? Verse 12.
Then David commanded the young men, and they killed them and cut their hands and feet and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in a grave of Abner.
All right, so they punked these guys, cut off their hands and their feet. They embarrassed them and then hang them on the wall in Hebron to show everybody else that's not cool. Don't do that. But they take Ishbosheth's head, they bury him, they honor him as best they can, and David's continuing to put down these things. Now, David continued to have these PR issues rise up in his life, like what's going on, right, that he's going to have to continue to battle. Yeah, Katie?
How does God feel about murder? I mean, I know they murdered him, but like, murder is like murder.
Same. This is not cool. God's not cool with this. David's not cool with this. It's bad all the way around.
But
so.
Punishing
him, absolutely. Yeah, for a crime committed, an eye for an eye, like that's, you take a man's life, your life is expected of you. That's okay.
You may have already said this, but why did they kill him? Like, just to get in with David?
I think they were trying to look for an in with David. Yeah, exactly. This was a way to exalt themselves in David's kingdom.
But they got nubs.
And they got the exact opposite of what they expected. So, all right. Hi.
He's Snapchatting.
No, it was.
What is the connection between how, you know, the one guy, whatever, I killed Saul, and this person I killed Ishbosheth?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the connection between Ishbosheth and the rest of the army? Like, them taking out this person, Ishbosheth, it wasn't a key tactic even to begin with. So, like, them
Symbolic.
Coming up and just killing Ishbosheth. Like, was Ishbosheth on a rise to take over David? Was
no.
He against it? Did he, like,
it's symbolic. Saul had four sons, right? If we're going to have a dynasty, you got to have a son. The only remaining son is Ishbosheth. If I kill him, the dynasty's gone. I've put down any chance of a coup, David. You're welcome, is what they're looking for.
Oh, okay.
There's no chance that Saul's going to come back and take over your kingdom.
But wouldn't have Ishbosheth made a move by now and saying...
In a sense, and that's what makes these guys so weak. Like, dude, we've been dealing with this for years. Abner's dead. At the very last moment when Ishbosheth is his absolute weakest, then you go in and murder him? Like, so, but he's dead. So he can't hide. He can't recover. He can't build an army behind the scenes. There's no coup coming in a decade. I put it down for you. So they're looking for a big fat thank you from David and get the opposite.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So this is Game of Thrones before there was Game of Thrones. So.
All the good stuff comes from the Bible.
Yeah.
It's such a bad feeling to expect one thing and get it.
Yeah.
Well, these guys are just dumber than the day is long. I mean, they should have known better. They've seen and heard how David handled this exact situation. Somebody trying to get rewarded for something they shouldn't have been doing, right? So it's bad. Okay.
How does David discipline these guys? But
He kills them and cuts their hands and feet off.
Not
so
discipline.
Yeah, that's I think that's discipline enough. Okay.
Did they not get the rest of
yeah, they got his head. I don't know. You figure that one out. Maybe that's what they could get. All right. Now, chapter 5.
Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Previously, when Saul was your king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you shall be a ruler over Israel." So all the elders of Israel came to the king of Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron, and they anointed David king over Israel.
All right, what's happened here?
Now David's king.
Now David's king. The rest of the folks come together, and they say, "Man, you're our guy."
How long did this take?
This took an additional 7.5 years. So David was anointed. The season we just read about from chapter 2 to chapter 5 was 7.5 years of turmoil with Ishbosheth and this Admiral Joab fiasco, but now the rulers of the people of Israel, the people that were loyal to Saul, come and say, "David, you're our guy. We're publicly making an announcement. You are now king over all of us." And they anointed David king over Israel. So he has now the entire nation's loyalty. Verse 4, we get a marker. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. Now think about that. It has been from a 13-year-old boy in 1 Samuel 16 when God said, "You're going to be the next king," until today, almost two decades, from promise to fulfillment. God can be exceedingly slow in his promises at times. He's never late, but boy, he is slow. So David has had to wait two decades almost for this to be fulfilled in him. So think about that. That's just, as we think about, again, our lives and the scope of God's promises and what's going on, David's 30 and he's going to be 37 and a half. Is that right? No. Yeah. By the time he gets all the kingdoms united underneath him. Insane. Okay. So he's got, yeah.
Sarah brought up a good point in that God promised Abraham and it took him
25 years. Yeah. God likes to work in decades, not days, right? Freak, I don't like that. I don't like decades. Yeah, it's all the same to God, right? When you're infinite and eternal. But we're not God. We like it on our timetable.
Is that a
decade? Do you mean a millennium by that or what? Now, I want you to write over verse 7. I want you to write the word Camelot. This is as good as it's ever going to get. In Israel, you're going to watch a righteous, godly king rule in Israel. From chapter 5, verse 7, all the way through chapter 11, okay, until a certain gal by the name of Bathsheba comes on the scene. We are going to see David at his best. This is a David that's worth emulating, and we're going to see how the people respond to him. This is amazing, amazing stuff, okay? So, up to this point, the capital has been, David set up shop in Hebron. Saul has been in Mizpah and a couple different places, but Jerusalem is not the capital, okay? It's a very strategic city. It's a great place, but it's not occupied currently by David and his men, okay? So now, let's pick up in 5 verse 7.
Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David.
Okay, Zion, Jerusalem, city of David, Jerusalem, same place, okay?
David said on that day, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind who are aided by David's soul through the water tunnel. Therefore they say, the blind or the lame shall not come into his house.
All right, so David is going to have to get into what is now called the city of David, just to get an idea. This is the topography of Jerusalem, okay? Again, it sits at like 2,300 feet elevation. It's the highest point in the land. Okay, you guys remember I walked you through a little bit of the land stuff. If you're going to have a tell, a place that you're going to set up shop, what were the main needs? If you're going to have a place where you're going to, you want elevation. Okay, why elevation?
Protection.
Protection. You want a defensible location. High ground is always the advantage. Okay, what else?
Water.
You need water. Okay, that's important. And food. Okay, yes, food, water, defensible location. Jerusalem has all three, okay? They have a water tunnel that's been made by the Canaanites back in the day. Their water source is kind of outside the city walls, and they had to bring it back in through a tunnel, okay? There's another king by the name of Hezekiah that's going to build a wickedly sophisticated water tunnel that Sean and I, Tessa, got to walk through when we're in Israel. It's insane. They literally bored a hole through a mountain with picks and 5-gallon buckets from Home Depot and took all the stuff out. It is 3 football fields in length long. It's almost 1,000 meters, and you can walk through it, and it's insane. It's all underground, and it's through bedrock. It's not through, like, soil. It's insane, okay? But that's how bad you needed water, and they had to get it from outside the city to bring it in. So obviously flowed downhill into the city and dropped into what's called the Pool of Siloam. But as you think big picture, as we see the city of David, this piece right here is David's original city, okay? So just this, that black outline here is where David's going to set up shop, okay? This is the Temple Mount up here. Solomon will expand up here. You guys remember Mount Moriah? This is Mount Moriah, where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, literally, is right here, okay? this is the highest point on this area. David is going to draw up plans for the temple later. We'll see that as that's coming. Solomon will build it. Okay, so it goes from this little city of David. And by the way, this is the Kidron Valley right here. So this is this big valley. And then up and over are these like lands and houses on the other side of the valley that comes up. Okay, David's people probably would have lived across the way. David's palace is here. So he's got this sweet view to the east over the Kidron Valley. By the way, this is the Mount of Olives where Jesus goes. This is all kind of on this side. Okay, Solomon will expand to here with his first temple construction. And then this ultimately, this will be a wall that's built all the way around Jerusalem in New Testament times. And it's going to be this gigantic complex. Herod is going to be the guy that makes this thing like crazy big during Jesus' day. Okay, so just to give you an idea of the scope, and I'll show you guys some temple pictures and stuff like that as we get closer, some renderings from each temple construction. But just to get the idea, David's the guy that says, man, Jerusalem, that needs to be home base. That is the city to have. So they're going to attack Jerusalem. How? Did you guys see that in verse, Alex, you read it. Verse 8, how do they come in? Through the water tunnel. Man, so they're coming through like sewage pipes, basically, to attack the city. And they say the Jebusites that live there, the blind and the lame can defend this city. We don't even need people that can see. It's so defensible. We can put the people that can't hear and can't see up there and can't fight. It doesn't matter. You can't come in and beat us, which is why no one's taking it down. And David says, the heck you say, verse 9.
David lived in a stronghold and called it the City of David. And David built all around the Milo, and inward.
Never mind the elephants upstairs. So David takes the city, kicks the Jebusites out. David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. That's awesome. Underline that. God is going to be with David through this season. He takes Jerusalem, and we're going to see God blessing everything David does. Okay? Read verse 11.
Hiram, the king of Tyre, sent messengers to David with cedar trees and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a house for David.
All right, so Hiram, king of Tyre. Tyre's to the northeast in Lebanon, okay? Northwest. They have cedar trees, which is what Israel doesn't have. Israel has a bunch of rock. Hiram is going to be a guy that continues this really cool relationship with David. They're buddies right now. Imagine that. Israel and Lebanon, buddies. And they've got this really cool relationship. So he sends wood. David builds a palace. Okay. David realized, verse 12, this is rad. Read this.
David realized that the Lord had established him king over Israel and that he exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel.
So why did God make David king? For the sake of his people. Because David's a what? He's a shepherd. He's a shepherd. That is why he's a great king. Okay, it is that harmonizer side of David that makes him amazing with people. And God didn't exalt David for David's sake. God exalted David to shepherd the people and care for them. Does that make sense? So, and David gets that. I'm a tool, and you're putting me here because of a skill set and a gifting that you've given me, not for me, but so that I can bless others with my position. So David gets it. This isn't Saul where power's going to go to his head and he's about all these wrong motives. David realizes, man, all those years I spent in the middle of nowhere taking care of sheep, cleaning up after them, feeding them in this miserable, you know, unthankful job. That's why God has me here. He's prepared me to take care of people.
Sorry to debunk your point. Hiram, is that relationship originally, obviously it says this is a good relationship, but was that originally a relationship established when he was with the Philistines?
Tyre's further up north, way, way north of the Philistines. So he's not a Philistine. He is in modern-day Lebanon, so way up north. So I think they're just they don't compete with one another. So they're in different markets. They don't care, but they're buddies. So Hiram's certainly not a believer, doesn't follow the God of David, but they've got a relationship where we're going to see that extends on even to Solomon and so forth. We'll see with Nehemiah. That relationship's going to continue through these two kingdoms that just decided, it's like us in Canada, right? It's like, oh, okay, you know, let's be buddies. Why not? That's the idea. Okay. So, okay? Not an evil thing, okay? No, it's good. Okay? Yeah, Katie. No, he does. The Jebusites say, man, there's no way you can get in here. And David says, the heck, yeah, I can. He comes in through the water tunnel.
So he went through the water tunnel and then he established.
Correct. Yeah, so he boots the Jebusites out. We don't get a whole lot on the battle. But David wins the battle, even though they thought the city was literally impenetrable. That's the N-word I've been looking for, yes. And lo and behold, they lose. So David comes and sets up shop. And now the capital of Israel is Jerusalem. This is the new place, okay?
Well, the battle was verse 7, yeah.
Yeah, so you get David captured the stronghold at Zion, that is the city of David. So this is the place where the Jebusites lived previously, their stronghold, their highest peak or whatever, and they had obviously probably houses and palaces and on a smaller scale there, and David kicks them out and lives in their houses. And now he's going to start building.
But it skips over when he was in Judah for 7 years?
That's since chapter 2. When they initially was king, that period that we've read from 2 to here is the, this is a summary statement of what has happened. And now they're saying 7.5 years into his reign, he finally gets the rest of Israel. So he'll enjoy 33 years with the united kingdom. Okay. So of his 40-year reign, 7.5 years, he only had the south in Judah. Now he's got the whole kit and caboodle. Okay? Good question. Now it gets confusing. Okay? So meanwhile, verse 13, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem, and he came to Hebron. More sons of daughters, sons and daughters were born to David. Now these are the names of those that were born to him in Jerusalem. And we get a list here, and one of them is Solomon there in verse 14. Solomon obviously hasn't come yet. That story is still coming. So this is a summary statement of what's going to happen in the future. But David is going to have ultimately, as we look at our map that's no longer up there, 8 wives and 10 kids from 7 different wives.
It's a good life in Jerusalem.
Man, right? Michael bears David no kids, by the way. They don't have a kid together, okay? So he has 8 wives, 7 of them bear children. He has 10 total. So that is a disaster, right? And then he's going to have 9 more kids from concubines, okay? So you have 16 women in your life that bear you children. Does that sound like fun to manage? Like, that sounds like a disaster, right? Man, you can see what's going to become of David's life, right? And why it's going this way, okay? Now, verse 17. Alex, pick up there.
When the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to seek out David, and when David heard of it, he went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines came and spread themselves out in the valley of Rephaim. Then David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said, "Go up, I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand."
So they come and they yeah.
Not I will give them to your hand, or they are in your hand, a certain
moment. Isn't it cool just to see how God speaks to David? Shall I go up? Go up. Where do you want me to go? Hebron. Okay. Shall I go fight the Philistines? Yep. Are you going to deliver me my hand? Absolutely. Like, dang. Like, there's just this assurance of, like, God is blessing David for God's sake, right? To exalt his people, because David has the humility to lead as a guy that recognizes, I'm a shepherd. This isn't about me. So God's blessing him. Keep going.
So David came to
Baal-perazim,
and defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breakthrough of water." Therefore, he named the place Baal-perazim. They abandoned their idols there, so David and his men carried them away.
All right, man, they're getting rid of idols. This is the Philistines. They carry them away. The Philistines came once again and spread themselves in the valley. David inquired of the Lord, "You shall not go up directly. Circle around them, behind them, and come in front of the balsam tree." So God says, you're not going to defeat them the same way. You're not going to come and do like a sneak attack from behind. And listen to this in verse 24, if this is not the coolest thing you've ever heard in battle.
"It shall be when you hear the sound of the marching in the tops of the balsam trees that you act promptly, and then the Lord will have gone out before you and strike the army of the Philistines."
The top, the sound of the marching in the tops of the balsam trees. That's the idea. Like, it's obviously the wind that they're hearing in the tops of the trees, in these tall trees. And God says, when you hear that, you know that I'm going out before you. And it's almost like this angelic idea, if God's going to go fight your battle, and then you'll know that I'm there. Verse 25, David did so just as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines far as Geber and as far as Gezer. Where's Gezer? Why is Gezer an important city? Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, gateway city to the west of Jerusalem. You better know those, okay? Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, same in your sleep backwards, okay? I want you to wake up mumbling those in your speech. So they've now taken a key city west of Jerusalem that's a gateway into Jerusalem. So now they've set up shop there. They now have defended Jerusalem. So they pushed the Philistines back that, remember, a couple chapters ago with Saul, had pushed all the way up into the Judah Mountains and were kicking Saul's people out over the other side of the Jordan River. So David is taking back territory, pushing the Philistines back into the coast where God ultimately wanted them to begin with, or actually eradicated from the land, but here they are, okay? So, you with me? David's taking land. He's setting up shop in Jerusalem. God's blessing him. The people are blessed. Chapter 6 now.
What were the things you were saying that we should really remember?
The gateway cities? No. The map?
Now,
it's in Dropbox. The map is.
Now the verse 25, the armies fell by the hand of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So David wasn't running against Israel. It's just that's how far the armies fell. Yeah.
I would assume that it's kind of a both and. David's doing battle with his men, and God's blessing it. So I think it's a dual thing. Yeah. Okay. 6 verse 1.
David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him in Baal Judah to bring, of Baalei Judah, to bring from the ark of God, which is called by the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim.
So David goes to a place called Baalei or Baal Judah. The other name for the city is Kiriath Yearim. Okay? What is in Kiriath Yearim, according to verse 2?
The Ark.
The Ark. You guys remember the story when at the very beginning of 1 Samuel, Israel goes into battle, they take the Ark, they lose, they get spanked by the Philistines. The Philistines then take it, they bring it into the land, they drop it in the house of Dagon, and Dagon dies, and then they get spread with like hemorrhoids and tumors and everything, and they realize, we don't want the Ark, let's send it back. And they put it on a cart, and they send it to Bet-Shemesh. Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, Bet-Shemesh. The men of Bet-Shemesh get it and they realize, man, we looked in it, and people died. Like, we don't want it. Send it away. Send it to Abinadab, who lives in Kiriath Yearim, and make it his coffee table in his house. The ark has been there through the reign of Samuel for 20 years, then through the entire reign of Saul for 40-plus years. We find out that basically the ark has been there for close to 100 years. It's been sitting in some dude's barn with a tarp over it. And Saul doesn't care about it. None of the other people care about it throughout Samuel's reign. Nobody wants to touch it. What does David want? The ark. Why would you want the ark? Yeah. On a half-full version, why do you want the ark? It's a symbol of power. What is the ark in terms of the tabernacle? What rests upon the ark? The Spirit of the Lord, the presence of God. So what is David making a statement about? I want the presence of God in my house. Bring him to Jerusalem. This is God's house. I want him here. Now, what else does the ark do? On a good day when Israel's not in sin and you bring it into battle. Yeah, dude, it rocks. It's like your lucky rabbit's foot. Like, it wins battles. It wrecks shop. Like, man, let's bring it because I want the power that comes from the ark. So David's going to go get it, okay? So he says, man, let's go get this ark. This is a great idea. Verse 3.
They placed the ark of God on a new cart and that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzziah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart.
All right. Sean gave me a good noise, and I know what that means. What do you guys see in verse 3? How do they move the ark?
On a cart.
On a new cart. How do we move the ark?
Take the pole. You have two people on the back, two on the front.
The poles, right? It's carried by who?
Priests.
The priests, specifically the?
I mean, Levites.
The Kohathites, right? God was specific in even what family of the Levites could carry it. Not the sons of Merari. Not the sons of Gershom, but the sons of Kohath, the Kohathites, were the only ones to carry the ark. Now, Philistines did this. They got away with it, right? They put it on an ark. They sent it to Bet-Shemesh. God said, man, that's fine. You don't have the law. I don't expect you to obey it. David has the law. He should know better. David, read your Bible. And the Bible would tell you that's not how you carry the ark. So there's these two guys, Uzzah and Ahio, that are leading kind of the front, the procession going back into Jerusalem. Verse 5 now.
Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all the kinds of instruments made of fir wood and the lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals.
So paint for me a picture of this day. What's going on? Dude, they're losing their minds, right? They are freaking out. They're excited. They're celebrating. Where's David's heart in this? Dude, it's golden. It's totally in the right spot. Yes? He has, if you were to look at this and say, spirit and truth, like in that kind of that balance, David is full of the spirit. He loves the Lord. He is in fuego. They're having a procession. They're honoring God. Like this is, everybody hears it. What's the problem?
They're doing it wrong.
They're doing it wrong. They've abandoned truth for the sake of the spirit. Watch what happens.
But when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, but the oxen nearly upset it.
So they're walking, and this oxen hits a bump on the cart, and the ark is literally about to fall off the cart. So Uzzah does what?
Grab it.
Right, totally. Grab it. Don't let the ark fall down. That would be bad. So what happens?
The anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah and struck him down for his irreverence, and he died there at the ark of the God.
Whoa. So this guy reaches his hand out to keep the ark from falling, and what does God do?
Instantly smokes him.
This is like Indiana Jones. Zzz, you're dead. If you're David, you're like, what the heck, man? We're in the middle of a party, right? And now we're having a funeral. Like, this is not at all what I expected, and David can't figure out what's going on. Verse 8.
David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place was called Perez Uzzah to that
day. So what's David's response? What the heck are you doing, God? We're having a party here. You just ruined our whole day. Like, he's mad at God and can't figure out why this happened. And if you look at Uzzah, poor guy, where's his heart? In the right spot. He's just trying to keep the ark from falling down in the dirt. Like, that's a good thing. So what does David do? Verse 10. I'm sorry.
Verse 9.
So David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord to the city of David with him, but David took it aside to a house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite.
Okay, so the Gittite, Obed-Edom now, is going to keep the ark until David can figure out what the heck's going on. So he hasn't put the pieces together as to why God is displeased in this moment. And David's just lost a faithful man because of this and doesn't know why. Keep reading.
Thus the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom.
So this ark does what for Obed-Edom and his family? Blessing. It's a blessing. Okay? So I don't know what the blessing is, but it's clear to David and clear to all those around him. The ark of God's in your house. Was it Kiriat Yearim? Now it's at Obed-Edom's house. Everybody that's got the ark gets blessed. Give me the half empty version of David as to why he would want the ark. I want the blessing. I want all the good stuff that comes with having the ark. Was David real concerned about following God correctly in this moment? No. Now he's gonna. But there's some fascinating theories out there as to why David's really doing this. It could be half full, and you can see this has made a great move on David's part, or maybe half empty. So now watch what he does in verse 12.
Now it was told King David, saying, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on the account of the ark of God. David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with gladness.
So why does David go get the ark? He hears, hey, dude, Obed-Edom is like winning the lottery, right? He's driving a Lamborghini, like God is blessing, whatever. God's blessing his socks off. David's like, whoa, I'm king. I went to go get that. I want the ark. So he goes and gets it. Now, we don't see it here, but in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, guess how David goes and gets the ark. What do you think he does differently? He does it exactly according to Levitical law. And it says in the text that the Kohathites carry the ark with poles back to the house of Jerusalem. Okay? So we see David finally finds his Bible, reads it, and goes, oh, that was my fault. That's why Uzzah died. We need to do it this way. In verse 13, what do they do? So it was when the bearers of the ark of the Lord, the Kohathites, had gone six paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. So they are now finally taking spirit and truth and combining them as they should be. David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod, this linen bathrobe. So David's zeal is the same as it was, but what does he combine it with? Truth, right? This is a great picture, by the way, of churches, right? These are the two extremes that we tend to swing to. All spirit and no truth, or all truth and no spirit, right? We worship God, you know, at the well. Like, what side of that spectrum do we at this church specifically have danger of falling into? Truth. All truth and no spirit, right? Worship God with your hands in your pockets. Don't raise your hands above your head. God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Bible. You know, not spirit isn't present here. Yes. We need to be aware of that. That's a legitimate danger, right? The spirit is alive and active, and we need to be aware of that. That's a danger. Now, there are other churches that swing to the other side, right? That are all spirit and no truth. And you got people laying down in the aisles barking in holy laughter that are climbing poles. I was doing a wedding one time. I'll never forget this. For this kid, this military kid, nice family, and their family was inviting me to church. I'm like, you realize I'm the pastor, right? I actually go to a church. I'm employed by a church. And they were inviting me to their church because they kind of thought ill of ours. And I'm like, well, tell me about it. I'm like, oh, man, it's awesome. There's like holy laughter and holy dancing and holy barking. Like, we got people that like will climb the poles during the service. I'm like, what? Like, show me. Like, where in the world is that found in your Bible? And their point was, like, your church has no spirit. And they've taken it a little bit too far. Churches can get wacky when this gets out of balance. So remember that. David's life got jacked. His heart was right, but he wouldn't follow what the truth said. Now he's combined a zealous heart, right? He is singing, he's dancing, and he's found truth to couple with that. And now he's going to honor God, okay? And watch what happens now in verse 15 and following.
So David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouting and the sound of the trumpet. And it happened as the ark of the Lord came to the city of David that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in his heart.
All right, so we'll pause there for today.
And on that
note. Yeah, that's a depressing note. So what does she see, by the way? What does David look like at this point?
Dancing naked.
He's not naked. This is a shame basis culture, so he's not naked. What is he wearing? It's a long linen bathrobe. Down to your ankles. He's dancing in his underwear. Okay? Where did Michal grow up?
Saul's house.
House of Saul. What does a king wear? You dance in your underwear publicly? Heck no, right? That's crazy. You put on royal garments that show you're the king. So to her, he looks the fool because he is the same as everybody else. He hasn't exalted himself. He doesn't look the part of a king. He looks like a commoner. He looks like a fool. So she despises him. And then David's going to make a great statement here in a minute. We'll get to it next week about this.
David's not wrong.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think David's right. And I think he was wrong at the beginning, and it cost a guy's life. But at this point, David's right. Now, his motives, I still question a little bit. And we'll get to that here in a bit. And I'll show you why I question them on Thursday. But his heart's great. He wants God's presence in his kingdom. He's willing to look like the fool or not royalty, not exalt himself over everybody. He's just dancing. He's responding in spirit, right, in a right way. And I think that's a good thing, okay? So we'll pause there. We'll pick up there on Thursday, all right? You guys have a great weekend. Enjoy your time. Enjoy the weather, and we'll see you guys on Thursday. Good job. Mm-hmm. Mashahoo.